My life's in you, my strength's in you, my hope's in you, in you.
This is a presentation of the Durham Church of Christ in Durham, North Carolina. We are located at 5224 Wake Forest Highway. If you are ever in the Durham area, we hope that you will come by and visit us.
This is my Father's world. That could be the theme, if you will, of the book of Habakkuk, as we've been looking at this in a series during our Sunday evening worship services. We've noticed several things within the book of Habakkuk thus far, and we're going to continue our study this evening. But one of the biggest themes is indeed that the world is the Father's. It is God's world. He is in control. We notice that Habakkuk is confused within this book. He starts off wanting to weigh what he sees before him, seeing his own people denying the Lord and living in a way that is not consistent with the law that they have been given. And he's wondering how long this will take place. He's been crying to the Lord and wants to know how long shall he cry, verse 2 of chapter 1. But as he begins to weigh what he sees before him, he stays to hear God's response. Although maybe it took a while for God to respond and it wasn't on Habakkuk's timetable, it was on the Lord's timetable. The world is the Lord's, and so the Lord responded when it was time, and Habakkuk stayed to hear the response. But then we notice that Habakkuk obeyed. He obeyed the Lord. He obeyed in that which the Lord commanded him to do, which was to write. And we examined in our previous lesson verses 1 through 4 of chapter 2. But tonight we're going to see that in times of confusion, Habakkuk conveys. You know, what he is about to write is not only going to be beneficial to those who will read it, but it's going to be beneficial to Habakkuk, the one that is confused. Have you ever been talking with someone before and they begin to tell you something and explain how they see something a certain way, and you step back for a moment and you realize and you ask yourself, are they trying to tell themselves that? In other words, they're saying it, but they're still trying to catch up into believing it themselves. Well, here Habakkuk is conveying what is going to come of the Chaldeans, that is the Babylonian army. And as he conveys it to his readers, likewise, he's going to be conveying it to himself. And that's going to help him with his confusion. Folks, it helps us when we talk about things. That's why we're so blessed to have the church. You know, the church is not a building. The church is not just a check in the box certain times throughout the week. The church is a family. The church is God's people. And we are so blessed to be able to have one another, to be able to bounce ideas off, to be able to challenge one another spiritually and challenge one another as we wrestle with difficulties within our own lives. Well, here Habakkuk is wrestling with some confusion. And he's going to convey what is going to take place upon the Chaldeans. Because you'll remember, God explains that the Chaldeans in chapter 1 there, verse 6, is going to come upon Israel and punish Israel. Well, Habakkuk's confused about that. We've already noticed these things, but just for a reminder, verse 13 he's stating, how can you send someone who's even more unrighteous than we are to punish us? But God is saying, no, wait. The Babylonians, they're going to be punished as well. You just wait, Habakkuk, and here are five woes that Habakkuk conveys regarding the Babylonians. Woe number one. In times of confusion, we see Habakkuk conveys a woe to him that increaseth that which is not his. Notice verse 5, beginning of chapter 2. Yea, also, because he transgresseth by wine, he is a proud man, and neither keepeth at home, who enlargeth his desire as hell, and is as death, and cannot be satisfied, but gathereth unto him all nations, and heapeth unto him all people. Shall not all these take up a parable against him and a taunting proverb against him and say, woe to him that increaseth that which is not his. How long? And to him that ladeth himself with thick clay. Shall they not rise up suddenly that shall bite thee and awake that shall vex thee, and thou shalt be for for booties unto them. Because thou hast spoiled many nations, all the remnant of the people shall spoil thee because of men's blood, and for the violence of the land, of the city, and of all that dwell therein. The people of Babylon were an evil people. And here we're seeing there is a woe pronounced unto them because they were increasing that which is not theirs. And how long were they going to do that? And to him that ladeth himself with thick clay. There, verse 6. Well, we're going to examine, as we look at these woes, the textual understanding, the historical understanding, and the applicable understanding. Let's begin with the textual. Your translation may be different there at the end of verse 6, and to him that ladeth himself with thick clay. Well, the word ladeth means to be rich. He's making himself rich with thick clay. What is thick clay? Well, other translations, such as the American Standard Version, states that it is pledges. In other words, taxes. Well, thick clay makes sense, because really, what are coins? All in all, really, coins are nothing but really just thick clay. And so they were making themselves rich off thick clay, and they were increasing in that which was not theirs. Now, when a nation does this, when a nation continues to burden its people more and more, what generally, based upon history, let's get into the historical, takes place? A rebellion. Even throughout the Bible, we see, for example, when the kingdom was divided in 1 Kings chapter 12, when we see the divided kingdom coming about, we notice that the reason it came about was because of the burden that was going to be laid upon Israel. Rehoboam increased the burdens. Notice verse 11 of 1 Kings chapter 12. And now, whereas my father did lay you with a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father hath chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scorpions. Rehoboam here wants to come on top even more and bring an even greater burden upon the people of Israel. But notice how they respond. Verse 16. So when all Israel saw that the king hearkened not unto them, the people answered the king, saying, what portion have we in David? Neither have we an inheritance in the son of Jesse to your tents. O Israel, now see to thine own house, David. So Israel departed unto their tents. We see the divided kingdom taking place. We see then Judah being referenced as one kingdom and Israel being referenced as another kingdom. And the reason being was because a burden was being placed upon them that was just too great and the people would not take it anymore. We see this throughout secular history. We see the people of the colonies rising up against England and engaging in the Boston Tea Party, for example, where they were proclaiming to England by a show of deeds that they were no longer going to take the tax burden that was being placed upon them. They wouldn't have it anymore. Well, that's the point that God is making here in Habakkuk chapter 2. God is stating that, yes, Babylon, you indeed are increasing in that which is not yours. You're getting rich off taxes. But when that happens, guess what? Rebellion is coming. It would be the quest for power by Babylon that would ultimately result in their loss of power. Babylon would be destroyed. And this is the first woe that's pronounced unto them. Now, what can we learn from this woe? Well, we can understand that if we desire to be rich, we're never going to be satisfied. We're never going to be satisfied. It is a great woe unto us as a people, because the temptation is so great. Because those around us, those that we work with, those with even our own families, are motivated and driven by riches. And in doing so, they are seeking that which they will never, ever gain. Verse 5 is interesting of Habakkuk 2 when we consider Proverbs 27 and verse 20. Hell and destruction are never full, so the eyes of man are never satisfied. Those that labor to be rich, The Proverbs writer says, cease from thine own wisdom. If you're laboring to be rich, you're being wise in your own sight. And you're never going to be satisfied. How much is enough? Well, there isn't. But how much is enough for us? Well, Paul tells us in 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 8, having food and raiment, let us be therewith content. The Babylonians were seeking to become rich. And they were seeking to be rich by feeding upon the wealth of others. And in doing so, they ultimately would be destroyed. Their seeking for power would cause them to lose their power. But we ought not to be seeking power. We ought not to be seeking riches. Rather, we ought to be seeking to serve. That's the greatest grade, the greatest office that we can hold within the church is that of a servant. Jesus states in Matthew 20, verse 27, and whosoever shall be chief among you, let him be your servant. The Babylonians wanted to get it right. Rather than seeking to become rich for their own gain, they could seek to take in what was necessary to then help and assist others and serve others. But they wanted to be wealthy on their own accord. In times of confusion, we see Habakkuk conveys a woe to him that increaseth that which is not his. But the second woe is found in verses 9 through 11. A woe to him that coveteth an evil covetousness to his house. Starting at verse 9 of Habakkuk 2. Woe to him that coveteth an evil covetousness to his house, that he may set his nest on high, that he may be delivered from the power of evil. Thou hast consulted shame to thy house by cutting off many people, and hast sinned against thy soul. For the stone shall cry out of the wall, and the beam out of the timber shall answer it. A woe is pronounced unto them because of their evil covetousness. Well, let's look at the textual understanding of this passage. What is evil covetousness? Well, they were seeking safety for themselves by destroying others. In other words, they were building up forts. They were coveting safety. And in order to do so, they had to go out and destroy the lives of other people. So they had an evil covetousness. Now, what does it mean there in verse 11? The stones cry out of the wall. Well, essentially, God is saying, your coveted material, your coveted forts, your coveted protection is going to witness against you on the day of judgment. They're going to speak out against you, and you're going to see, hopefully, where you were wrong and where you had erred from the Lord. The historical understanding that we can gain from this passage is the amazement of the forts that the Babylonians built. Their tall structures were something that they desired greatly. Their walls were 85 feet thick, 300 feet tall, 11 miles long. You could sit three chariots side by side on top of it. They had the idea, they had the mindset that because of their forts, they were invincible. Nobody could ever take them down. Well, here God is saying, well, because of what you did to gain all that and the reason why you wanted to gain all that, you're going to be destroyed. And that which you coveted is going to witness against you, and you're going to wish that you would not have sought after that. We can apply this to ourselves. When we are seeking selfish gain by destroying others, it's not godly. As a matter of fact, if we're seeking gain in any way, and in order to get that, we have to destroy others, it's just simply not godly. Take, for example, the lottery. The United States of America, the poorest citizens within this country, spend nearly 10% of their wealth or income or however they're making money on the lottery. That's higher than any other class. The poorest are spending 10%. And the whole justification for the lottery is better education. When all the while that education that is supposedly made better, statistics show us that it's not. Most of the time the money doesn't even go to education. And the states that run the lottery, those states actually spend less money on education and have worse education than the states that don't run a lottery. That's what the statistics show us. And who wins in a lottery? Well, you might have a couple of winners. But by having a couple of winners, thousands of lives have fallen deeper into poverty and financial despair because of it. The lottery is an evil covetousness. It's the desire to take of someone else so that they are then hurt by it. They gain nothing. They gain no service. They gain no product. No skill is involved. Others are destroyed for the gain of just very few. It's an evil covetousness. Jesus states in Luke 12, verse 15, "Beware of covetousness." If we covet dollars on the day of judgment, just like those stones are going to cry out, the dollars are going to be crying out at us. It's been stated before, just for illustration's sake, we better pay attention to the serial numbers on our dollars because they're all going to come back to haunt us on the day of judgment. Well, the idea is the same idea that is being portrayed here in Habakkuk chapter 2 and verse 11. James writes in James 5 verse 3, "Your gold and silver is cankered, and the rust of them shall be a witness against you and shall eat your flesh as if it were fire." If we are seeking gain based upon the destruction of others, it's an evil covetousness. And that's what Habakkuk is conveying to Babylon, a woe upon them. Habakkuk then moves on to convey a woe to him that buildeth a town with blood. Let's look at starting at verse 12. "Woe to him that buildeth a town with blood and establish a city by iniquity. Behold, is it not of the Lord of hosts that the people shall labor in the very fire, and the people shall weary themselves for very vanity? For the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea." Well, let's understand the textual point here, especially on some certain phrases. What does it mean to build a town with blood? They were killing people to get their way. That's basically what it means. Verse 14 there, "The earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea." What does that mean? Well, Babylon would eventually be destroyed by Medo-Persia. And God, through Isaiah, prophesied before Israel was even taken into captivity by Babylon, that Babylon would be destroyed by Medo-Persia. And God prophesied the very name of the king that would grant them access to be able to return to Jerusalem and build their temple. In Isaiah chapter 44, verse 28, Isaiah writes, "That saith of Cyrus, he is my shepherd, and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, thou shalt be built, and to the temple thy foundation shall be laid." This was prophesied 200 years before Cyrus was even giving this proclamation. It was prophesied 150 years before Cyrus was even born. And Isaiah names him by name. Folks, that's proof of biblical inspiration. And indeed, we see this being carried out in Ezra chapter 1, verses 2 through 3. We see the decree of Cyrus allowing the people of Israel to return, the people of God to return to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. Now, the specifics in regards to the historical destruction that Babylon would bring upon the towns that they destroyed, the towns that they built with blood, is quite disturbing. They would kill the parents of infant offspring right in front of them. They would kill the offspring, the infant offspring, right in front of the parents, and then they would pluck the eyes out of the parents. It's so bad, I almost don't even want to say it. But the Bible gives us an account of this in 2 Kings 25, 6 through 7. The Babylonians doing this very thing so that the parents would have the last image in their mind because their eyes were plucked out of their infants being murdered. These were disgusting people. And so they were building these cities with this type of blood by destroying people in this type of way. They were barbaric. Now, how can we apply this to us? Well, ultimately, God's going to take care of Babylon. They did did some pretty despicable and disgusting things. Hence the reason why Habakkuk cannot believe that he's going to send the Babylonians to destroy them because of how gross they are. But ultimately, God's going to take care of them. Now, we can apply this to us because we can realize that God is going to settle all injustice. And whatever God is going to do to settle that injustice is far greater than a couple angry individuals who want to take vengeance on an entire nation. That's the point. We need to remember when we struggle, and this is one of my favorite verses because sometimes you really want to take vengeance out on your own, but God is the one that deserves the right to take out vengeance. Romans chapter 12, verse 19. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I'll repay, saith the Lord. I quote that to myself often. That's one of my favorite memory verses. I rely upon it often. I have to remember that. I can't take the place of God and think that I'm going to take out vengeance because, number one, it's not going to compare to the type of revenge that the Lord's going to take out. And number two, it's removing God from the one that is to take out the vengeance. And I'm not God. And so the people of Israel would be comforted realizing that God was going to take care of them. And ultimately, God was going to be highly glorified because of this. Verse 14. The world is going to see the glory of the Lord because of that prophecy we refer to in Isaiah. The fact that indeed Medo-Persia is going to overtake Babylon and Cyrus will indeed allow God's people to return to build the temple. Let's look at the next woe. A woe unto him that giveth his neighbor drink. Starting there in verse 15. Woe unto him that giveth his neighbor drink, that puttest thy bottle to him, and makest him drunken also, that thou mayest look on their nakedness. Thou art filled with shame for glory. Drink thou also, and let thy foreskin be uncovered. The cup of the Lord's right hand shall be turned unto thee, and shameful spewing shall be on thy glory. For the violence of Lebanon shall cover thee, and the spoil of beasts which made them afraid, because of men's blood, and for the violence of the land, of the city, and of all that dwell therein. Babylon, out of all these woes, one of them is he that giveth his neighbor drink. Now, we live in a country and in a society that equates drunkenness and getting drunk and drinking with just eating breakfast. I mean, it's no big deal at all. And it certainly isn't on the same level as murder. But here in all these woes and in these lists of woes, this is one of them. Woe unto Babylon. Now, in specifically, Babylon was well known for the way that they would trick people. And indeed, guess what? Alcohol tricks people. And the Bible tells us very plainly it's going to trick people. Proverbs 20, verse 1. Wine is a mocker, strong drink is raging, and whosoever is deceived thereby is not wise. I don't want to be proclaimed by God by not being wise. Here we see wine mocks, strong drink rages, and ultimately deception is occurring. Notice chapter 23 and verse 32. And at last it biteth what? Wine like a serpent and stingeth like an adder. In other words, it is poison. I don't know about you, but I don't like snakes. I kind of put myself in the same boat as Dr. Indiana Jones, if you're familiar with that movie. And I can relate to him. When he falls in those pits and all those snakes, man, I mean, not me. I would never in my life pick up a snake, much less a poisonous one. And I know a lot of folks are that way. But yet some folks want to pick up the bottle and act like it's no big deal. But here, God is comparing picking up the bottle to a poisonous snake. Folks, it's poison and it's deception. And here, an entire nation is being pronounced a woe upon them because of drunkenness and them assisting neighbors in drunkenness. Now, the historical understanding of this passage is that Babylon was indeed very deceptive. The nation as a whole had lots of sorcerers and magical arts. They would always look to take advantage of people. So they were seeking to trick people. And here Habakkuk is using the phraseology of drunkenness to show how although they're tricking their neighbor, they are going to be destroyed because of that. We see Paul explaining to us that We are deceiving ourselves if we think by drinking we're going to go to heaven. You know, some of our very own brethren think that we can go to heaven drinking the bottle. That's not what the Bible says. Let's look at 1 Corinthians chapter 6. Starting in verse 9, we see, "Know ye not that the unrighteous shall not inherit the kingdom of God?" Notice, "be not deceived." In other words, there's some deception out there where some will maybe try to get you to think that you can still go to heaven even though you might engage in some of these things. Notice some of the things that he mentions. Who's not going to inherit heaven? Fornicators, idolaters, adulterers, homosexuals, thieves, covetous, drunkards, revilers, extortioners. Those aren't going to inherit heaven. Now, folks might say, well, one drink isn't going to hurt anything. Let me ask you a question. One session of adultery, is that going to hurt anything? Is one session of fornication, does that make you a fornicator? In the eyes of God, it does. How is it any different with drunkenness? The answer is it's not. And ultimately, we can't be deceived by this. We can't have the mindset that somehow we can drink and still go to heaven. Paul is telling us, be not deceived. Not only is the bottle going to try to deceive us, but likewise, society will also. And so we see a woe unto him that giveth his neighbor drink. And it also lets us notice that in John chapter 2, when Jesus was at the feast, and Jesus turned water into wine, that wine could not have been alcoholic. How do we know that? Because Jesus did not sin, neither was there guile in his mouth, as Peter tells us. And so if Jesus would have been giving his neighbor's drink, he would have been sinning against the law of God. And he didn't do that. So that's something to take away from this likewise. The fifth and final woe is a woe unto him that saith to the wood, awake. Let's read this, starting at verse 18 of Habakkuk chapter 2. What profiteth the graven image that the maker thereof hath graven it, the molten image and a teacher of lies, that the maker of his work trusteth therein to make dumb idols? Woe unto him that saith to the wood, awake, to the dumb stone, arise, it shall teach. Behold, it is laid over with gold and silver, and there is no breath at all in the midst of it. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. The last and final woe is because Babylon was an idolatrous nation. They would make these images, and they would say unto these images, after just making it, "It is my God." And I think the greatest description of how foolish this is found in Isaiah chapter 44. Starting at verse 13, Isaiah explains the creation of an idol. "The carpenter stretcheth out his rule. He marketh it out with a line." Verse 13 of Isaiah 44. "He fitteth it with planes, and he marketh it out with the compass, and maketh it after the figure of a man, according to the beauty of a man, that it may remain in the house. He heweth him down cedars, and taketh the cypress and the oak, which he strengtheneth for himself among the trees of the forest. He planteth an ash, and the rain doth nourish it." Folks, that's not talking about a Christmas tree. Just a side note. It's not a Christmas tree. This is an idol. They're making an idol. Verse 15, "Then shall it be for a man to burn, for he will take thereof and warm himself. Yea, he kindleth it and baketh bread. Yea, he maketh a god and worshipeth it. He maketh it a graven image, and he falleth down thereto. He burneth part thereof in the fire, with part thereof he eateth flesh. He roasteth roast and is satisfied. Yea, he warmeth himself, and he saith, Ah, I am warm. He hath seen the fire. And the residue thereof he maketh a god, even his graven image. He falleth down unto it, and worshipeth it, and prayeth unto it, and saith, Deliver me, for thou art my God. They have not known nor understood, for he hath shut their eyes that they cannot see, and their hearts that it cannot understand." Isaiah is saying, how foolish. You're going out to the woods and cutting down a tree. You're using part of the wood to make your food. You're using part of the wood to burn. You're using part of the wood then to make a god. And you fall down to it and worship it, and it has no eyes, no ears, and no heart. And that's what Babylon was doing. Babylon was idolatrous. They were asking these idols to speak, but they were not going to speak. That's what's being discussed there in verse 19 of Habakkuk chapter 2. Arise, and it shall teach. They're fooled. And finally, the Lord ends there. The Lord is in His holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before Him. In other words, if you want to hear revelation, keep silence before the Lord and listen to Him, because you'll get it. Don't go to an idol. You're not going to find it there. But come to the Lord and you'll hear His will. I can tell you this much. These passages show us hard evidence that all the world was amenable to God's law. Because here God is pronouncing five woes unto a nation and a people that are not His. And the declaration of those woes and of their sin is based upon His law. And so the people of Babylon were being judged and being judged by the law of Moses because they were failing to abide in the law of God. This day, all the earth is amenable to the law of Christ. Jesus states in John chapter 12, verse 48, "He that rejecteth me and receiveth not my words hath one that judgeth him. The word which I have spoken, the same shall judge him in the last day." Doesn't matter if someone says, "I want nothing to do with the law of Christ. I will not become a child of God." Jesus says, "You'll still be judged by me." Are you right with Jesus this evening? Have you been baptized into Christ for the remission of your sins? Have you become a member of His church? If you haven't, do so tonight, for it's everlastingly too late. If you've already become a Christian, are you faithful to God, or do you need to repent and come home? If you do, please do so. As all together, we stand and sing.